From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. Today, we take a look at a national sex trafficking roundup and the internet.
The internet has changed all that, particularly through social media platforms.
Plus, what is a dandy? A show at the Rhode Island School of Design Museum shows us.
Everyone from Dame Edna to Divines on there.
Lady Bunny.
And growing a shatterproof baseball bat.
Miguel Olivo breaks his bat.
We'll hear from musically inclined elephants in Thailand. Plus a new biography of cult leader and killer Charles Manson and a film by the comedian Robert Clive, When Comedy Went to School. That's all coming up on this podcast of Weekends on All Things Considered. This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. This week, the FBI announced its most successful child trafficking raid to date. The national operation, known as Operation Cross Country, is the seventh of its kind, and it highlights an ongoing problem in the U.S., the sex trafficking of young people.
It's a very bad lifestyle, and it's a very violent lifestyle. You know, you have a quota that you have to make, and if you don't make that money, you normally get your head busted.
That's Sheila Simpkins-McLean. We'll hear more from her later. During this raid, the FBI recovered 105 victims between the ages of 13 and 17 and arrested 150 pimps. But the way this kind of trafficking happens has changed significantly in the last several years, as is the way it's policed because of the internet. That's our cover story today, Sex Trafficking in the Digital Age. Before we talk about policing the internet for sex trafficking, one constant remains the same. Now, as then, the people likely to be trafficked are the young.
Up until about 5 years ago, sex trafficking for both adults and children were occurring in traditional venues like street corners, alleys, bus stops. The internet has changed all that, particularly through social media platforms.
That's John Ryan. He's the CEO of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They worked in partnership with the FBI on Operation Cross Country, collecting and analyzing information they received on missing and exploited kids. During the FBI raids, the office functioned like a command center, analyzing data gathered from the internet. Thousands of sites and social media have made it easier to be anonymous online. One of the most well-known online classified sites is Backpage.com. They cooperated with the FBI sweep.
For instance, the pimps now have found a very convenient and inexpensive platform on online classified spaces, such as Backpage, to promote their business and their enterprise. They post images of young adults or, unfortunately, many times, minors who they are offering for sale for johns. And, unfortunately, they are able to do that with very little investment. The postings are a modest cost. The most concerning feature is they do this in an anonymous fashion. So when Backpage encourages non-traditional payment schemes, that means that when law enforcement is seeking a lead who might be involved in these activities, they typically are finding a dead end.
What is a non-traditional payment scheme?
It could be a prepaid card where the purchaser does not have to leave any personal information or can leave any information, but it's not validated by any third-party source, which is more typical with a credit card.
And this kind of untraceable anonymity is causing much of the criticism of these online classified websites. Elizabeth McDougall is the general legal counsel for Backpage.com.
For the adult and the dating categories, we charge a fee. And one of the reasons for charging a fee is because that provides one of the most reliable evidentiary trails for law enforcement to identify individuals. It's true that we do not collect information on every user who would like to post an ad to our site, and that is not irregular in the internet realm.
A few years ago, Craigslist stopped listing ads for adult services under the pressure of an investigation. Backpage picked up a lot of the business. In fact, McDougall says that shutting down the adult classifieds on Backpage would do more harm than good.
When you shut down services like Craigslist or Backpage, who are domestic and who are cooperative, is that the content will migrate again, and it will migrate to the Black Hat and the offshore websites. They are not going to do the proactive work that we do at Backpage to try to identify potential victims and potential illegal activity and get that information to law enforcement that can use the information to investigate, arrest, and prosecute and get convictions of the traffickers.
She also says there are lots of precautions the site takes to flag down people who may be doing questionable illegal activities, like trafficking minors on the site.
There are two primary avenues where we can be helpful in that regard. First, we have a triple-tier moderation system that begins with the automated filtering of all content submitted for posting on the service. But then for the adult and for the dating category, we have a team of individuals who hand review every ad before it goes live on the site.
John Ryan at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children would like to see companies like Backpage.com take a more proactive approach.
By cooperation, they mean when law enforcement is submitting legal process, such as a subpoena or court order for information, they are cooperating. That's not what I call voluntary cooperation. That's responding to process, which they are obligated to do.
But the most important thing to keep in mind is that all of this technology has a direct effect on human lives. For Sheila McLean, that meant a life that was fractured by violence.
I know I've been duct tape tied up. I have a road map in my head from where I've been beat so many times. I've ran away numerous amounts of times. I've been found. It's a very bad lifestyle, and it's a very violent lifestyle. You know, you have a quota that you have to make, and if you don't make that money, you normally get your head busted.
Sadly, that part of sex trafficking hasn't changed. Other parts of it have.
When I was a teenager, there was no internet, so we were predominantly on the streets doing it. And so it's actually been a dramatic change, because now you don't really see the girls out on the streets, and so it's harder to be able to rescue them because they're behind closed doors.
Sheila McLean today is the assistant resident manager for Magdalen in Nashville, Tennessee, and an intervention specialist with End Slavery Tennessee. Those are two nonprofits that work to bring women out of prostitution. When she was 14, Sheila left home and became involved in sex trafficking. Now, many years later, she's dedicated her life to working with women who are coming out of situations similar to hers. And she says pimps have the advantage online.
That's the reason why it's easier for the traffickers to control the women, because they pretty much keep them locked up, you know. They control everything around them. Whereas back whenever I was in the lifestyle, we were allowed to move around because we were on the streets to get our money, and so it was a lot easier to get away if we really wanted to.
Research shows that the majority of domestic victims enslaved in the sex industry are runaway and homeless youth. The State Department estimates that about a third of the teens living on the streets are trafficked within 48 hours of leaving home. That's about 150,000 kids a year. They get lured in by pimps, says Sheila, who almost hypnotize young women.
A lot of them really think that they're in love, you know, and that they're doing it out of love. They don't really realize that what's going on is wrong.
And Sheila McLean helps to break that spell.
What do you say to a girl when she says, I just don't know if I can do this? Get out of this.
You can. Just tell yourself. Sometimes you have to do it minute by minute. Sometimes you have to do it second by second, you know. And then eventually they keep on telling themselves, you know, because you just got to hold on. You know that not every day is going to be a good day. Not everything is going to be comfortable. But I just tell them to hold on, you know, and just like they trusted the pimp, they need to learn how to trust us.
The runaways are obviously more vulnerable. It would be a mistake to think that kids in more stable environments are immune. John Ryan of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children points to the very county where his own organization is headquartered in Virginia.
Right here in Fairfax County, which is one of the most affluent communities in the nation with one of the best school districts, the FBI just arrested 5 pimps who were trafficking over the course of a number of years school children recruited from Fairfax schools and being sold and trafficked for sex. Those children were going home at night. They were going to school the next day, but they were being trafficked for sex. So we like to use this as a wake-up call. We need to do more. Everyone points to, and understandably so, the global human sex trafficking problem. It's a problem here in the United States.
Experts point out that there are thousands of websites and social media sites that traffic in underage prostitution. Even this unprecedented FBI sweep has rescued just a fraction of the children being exploited. Sheila McLean keeps that in mind. It's one of the motivations to keep her doing the work she's doing now. She and her colleagues recognize that more efforts need to be made to bring children out of prostitution.
This is a new adventure that I'm on right now, and guess what? I'm really, really loving it. God has kind of positioned me to be able to do something that my heart really, really enjoys, you know.
At Magdalene and End Slavery Tennessee in Nashville, she's helped hundreds of women recover their lives. At the end of the day, she goes home to her husband, her 2 kids, her own home, never forgetting how many younger versions of her former self are still out there, unseen. To hear more on this story and the FBI investigation that led to the rescue, tune in to Weekend Edition Sunday tomorrow. Host Rachel Martin spoke with FBI Assistant Director Ron Hosko about this persistent problem.
We think that we are trying to do the right thing and bring attention to this problem. But at our core, we're a law enforcement organization. We, by and large, don't provide social services. We don't have bed space at the FBI. Mm-hmm. And so that really points back to the importance of communities to find it in their budgets, to find it in their heart as they look at some engagement on the street, not to just think, well, look at that girl selling herself, because that girl could be a minor.
You can also see pictures and video of Sheila McLean and the Magdalene program from a previous series, Rising Up Out of Prostitution, on NPR.org. When I say the word dandy, what do you think of? Maybe the song Yankee Doodle Dandy, which dates all the way back to the Revolutionary War and compares the colonists to foppish, effeminate idiots, the dandies. But an exhibit at the Museum of the Rhode Island School of Design this summer reclaims the term. It explores dandyism through the ages, linking it to the cutting edge of men's fashion and style. The name of the show is Artist Rebel Dandy, Men of Fashion. And it still leaves you wondering, what are you going to see?
Am I going to see purple? Am I going to see lace? Am I going to see ruffles? What does dandy mean in the contemporary context?
That's Lori Brewer, the assistant curator of the show. She and co-curator Kate Irvin put a lot of thought into the question, what is a dandy?
It's about being an individual and expressing yourself creatively with certain passions and flair.
A man gets up in the morning and puts on a suit and tie, never knowing the debt he owes to the original dandy, Beau Brummel, the father of modern men's fashion, Kate Irvin.
He made himself through his clothes. He was born outside of the aristocracy.
The exhibit begins with Beau Brummel, a self-made man who joined the British Royal Regiment in the late 1700s in England.
He caught the eye of the future King George IV.
Who asked Brummel to dress him. That might sound strange today, but back then, believe me, it was an honor. Irvin points to a life-sized portrait of Brummel at the entrance to the exhibit, standing tall in a knee-length navy blue military coat.
He, in fact, stood against the frills and the silks of the court dress and instead embraced this very restrained but immaculately tailored image.
In other words, the forerunner of today's suit. This masculine, elegant style caught on quickly, but just as quickly, came to represent a hedonistic stereotype mocked in the popular press. Kate Irvin walks past a row of framed British political caricatures of the mid-1800s showing a limp-wristed popinjay.
The idea of connecting this focus on dress to femininity isn't pointing to gender preferences or sexual preferences. It's really just pointing to the fact that this person is out of place in his focus on fashion.
Here at the exhibit, all the focus is on fashion. Rounding a corner, the showroom opens to reveal spectacularly tailored suits in a rainbow of styles Beau Brummel could never have dreamed of. Bespoke suits, Lori Brewer explains.
Every single detail of that garment would be discussed with your tailor. So it's all about the dialogue with your tailor and that agreeance upon what that suit should become.
Maybe the best example is a lot of people, women, might have custom designed a wedding dress. Mm-hmm. I want the sleeve just so, I want the collar just so.
Dialogue, it's a conversation. Hmm. Yeah.
I'm putting down my top hat, mussing up a white tie, dancing in my tails.
On display here are bespoke suits worn by Fred Astaire, John Waters, a shirt from Oscar Wilde, Andy Warhol, and Samuel Clemens. Each visitor to the exhibit has his or her favorite outfit.
When I came across this particular suit, I immediately fell in love with it.
Ed Cabral stands in front of a suit by Japanese designer Motofumi Koji. The print is subdued from afar.
But when you look closer, you realize that it's Hello Kitty taking a tour of London.
Ed Cabral, where do you see yourself wearing this red, white, and blue Hello Kitty suit?
Well, my partner is here, and we've been together for 10 years, and now that Rhode Island has passed marriage equality, I think the proper answer would be wedding.
His cheering partner, Tripp Evans, has his eye on a different suit.
I think we may, you know, sort of pop everyone's eyes out if we were stood together in these two outfits. But
Evans leads us to a gray and white seersucker suit. Big, bold stripes, very modern-looking, but it's actually from the 19th century. But the real showstopper isn't part of the exhibit at all. Aaron Peterson walks into the museum dressed to impress, a real dandy in a suit he designed and sewed himself, neon yellow with what appears to be a kaleidoscopic print of colorful flowers. But close up.
Tiny drag queens, so everyone from Dame Edna to Divines on there.
There's Lady Bunny.
Yes, all the greats.
Lady Bunny, talk about a bespoke suit.
I literally got out of the car right across the street from the museum and got honked at twice, and someone's like, that's the best suit I've ever seen. So you got to save it for those perfect occasions.
So who's your dandy? My favorite definition from the exhibit comes from Thomas Carlyle. A dandy is a clothes-wearing man. Every faculty of his soul, spirit, and purse is consecrated to the wearing of clothes wisely and well, so that others dress to live, he lives to dress. If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. And after the show, what better to do with your sunny August evening than visit the old ballpark?
Should be a fun night. Strike one.
Now, if you go to a game today, there's something you're not too likely to see, a splintered bat. As recently as 5 years ago, though, bats were shattering all over the place. Why the drop? Well, bats made of maple were all the rage.
3 balls and 2 strikes.
In 2007, Barry Bonds used maple.
And Bonds hits one high!
To do a little thing called breaking the all-time home run record. When the next season started, more than half the league was using bats made out of maple, but they seemed to break a lot.
And he promptly hits one with a busted bat.
That season, a bat broke into pieces an average of once every game, like in this one on April 25th, 2008.
And part of the bat wound up in the stands.
Facing the L.A. Dodgers, the Colorado Rockies first baseman, Todd Helton, knocked a routine single into shallow center. His bat split at the handle, leaving just the bottom in his hands, while the larger, heavier upper half flew into the stands. It struck a fan in the face, knocking her out and breaking her jaw.
I'll tell you what, the bats they are making today apparently are awful.
A little later in the season, the Rockies were in Kansas City playing the Royals.
Miguel Olivo breaks his bat.
The Royals catcher, Miguel Olivo, knocked a bouncing grounder toward second base. His bat split at the handle and went spinning right into the head of Brian Onora, the home plate umpire, sending him to the hospital, too.
As it looks like he suffered a pretty serious gash.
That very day, the MLB's Safety and Health Advisory Committee had met to discuss the epidemic of broken bats and decided something needed to be done. And that's where Dave Kretschmann comes in.
I'm a research engineer at the USDA Forest Service Forest Products Laboratory in Madison, Wisconsin.
The MLB called Kretschmann because Dave is an expert on wood.
And you have a lot of choices when you grow trees. You can grow them fast, you can fertilize them, you can space them differently.
At the Forest Service's laboratory, Dave and his coworkers research things like construction lumber or what to do with the wood from trees killed by pine beetles. And they take phone calls from the public with tough wood-related questions. When the league asked for Dave Kretschmann's help, he said sure.
Because I have a sense of how wood breaks. I've broken a lot of wood over the years. And so, yeah, I certainly thought I'd be able to help him out.
There was one main pattern. Bats weren't splintering apart. They were breaking cleanly. Dave Kretschmann calls that a slope of grain issue. Wood doesn't hold up well when you put pressure perpendicular to the grain. So when the grain slopes at an angle through the cylinder of the bat, the pressure of hitting a fastball at just the right angle can split the bat in two.
If you looked at the handle and the player still held on to the knob in his hand and you looked at where it broke and there was an oval shape.
Now, maple bats had this issue more than any other wood. Dave Kretschmann and his team figured out enough to give recommendations in time for the 2009 season, and things have steadily improved since then. Now, the incidents of bats breaking are down by half, and Dave Kretschmann has changed too.
When I watch a game now, I pay attention to what bat's being used and what species it is and what happens, as opposed to kind of paying attention to the game.
I'm sure Major League Baseball takes comfort in that. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. In the summer of 1969, all eyes were on Los Angeles. Sharon Tate, a young movie star, 8 months pregnant, had been brutally murdered. A total of 8 people had died on 2 nights, and the police said a cult was responsible.
They called themselves The Family.
Three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and 6 others.
The leader of that cult was Charles Manson, charismatic, ruthless, and manipulative. America was captivated by Manson and by the young women who, under his spell, had helped murder people they didn't even know. But more than 4 decades after the murders, there is still much that is murky about Charles Manson's life. Jeff Gwynn has spent many years digging into his past. His new biography is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, and he joins me from member station KERA in Dallas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You begin his story with an incredibly detailed look at his childhood. You had access to family members and photos, which no one had ever had access to before. This boy, from the time he's able to verbalize, we see that something's wrong.
It was amazing how the patterns of his later life were evident right away. 6 years old, first grade, he's talking the girls in his class into beating up boys he doesn't like. Then when the principal comes to ask Charlie, why did you do that? Charlie's response is, it wasn't me. They were doing what they wanted. You can't blame me for that. The exact same defense he uses all those years later in the Tate-LaBianca trial.
You had a chance to speak to a cousin. You call her Joanne in this book. I assume that's not her real name.
I promised both Joanne and Manson's sister that I would not in any way describe them physically, where they lived, and I could only use their first names.
Right. Tell me, Joanne, she has misgivings, deep ones, about this child. Just tell me, how does his childhood contribute to who he becomes later?
Joanne, who at this point in Manson's life has known him longer than anybody else, her first statement about Manson to me was, there was never anything happy about him, never anything good about him. From the time he moved into her house with her and her parents, he lied about everything. Joanne feels that everything about Manson that happened later could not be a surprise to anyone who knew him as a child. And she said that to me over and over.
You also delve into his relationship with his mother, Kathleen. Can you tell me about that?
Manson has lied about everything in his childhood, every opportunity that he's had, and no one's ever really challenged him on it, though the record was there if you wanted to look far enough. He always claimed he was the child of an unwed teenage prostitute who tried to sell her baby once for a pitcher of beer. In no way is that true. His mother was an incompetent robber who went to prison when Charlie was five for a couple years for a spectacularly bungled attempted robbery. But there is no record anywhere that she was ever a prostitute, ever arrested. Thanks to finding Charlie's sister, we now know the mother's side. She tried desperately to help him, to keep him in school. She loved him, and to the end of her life, her heart ached for the things he did.
Once he gets out of the juvenile system, he tries for a few months to go straight. The only time in his life, he marries a teenage girl. He abandons her pretty quickly. And then he's out in California following his mother. He's almost immediately at Terminal Island Penitentiary in Los Angeles Harbor for car theft and pimping. And that's where you say he begins to really learn the art of manipulation from an unlikely source.
Most of Charlie's instruction so far in prison had come from other pimps. Charlie wanted to know how to run whores more efficiently. But in this prison, he discovers a class, Dale Carnegie. The Dale Carnegie courses are being taught to prisoners to help them adjust to the outside world. Later in life and in his trial, in his testimony, you hear people say over and over, "Oh, it was like he could read my mind. He came and talked to me, and it was like he was immediately the friend I'd wanted and never had." Every line he used, almost word for word, comes from a Dale Carnegie textbook in a class, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He took something that was meant to be positive and uplifting and turned it instead for his own evil purposes. He always did that.
At 32 years old, he finally ends a really long string of prison sentences, and he's free to go back to the streets and start pimping again. He moves to the Bay Area, eventually to Haight Street. It's the summer of love, 1967. You say that the culture at that time was almost the perfect laboratory for Charles Manson.
In Haight-Ashbury, it's supposedly a place where if you just want peace and love, come here, be brothers and sisters, share drugs, share sex, everything's wonderful. Manson immediately sees that the corner street gurus preaching philosophies attract all kinds of young, innocent followers who'll do anything they ask. Manson immediately begins cribbing a lot of their best lines. He remembers some of his Book of Revelation from his Nazarene upbringing, quotes the Beatles, and begins presenting himself as someone with all the answers.
You go into great detail about his relationship with the Beach Boys' Dennis Wilson. What new things did you find out about Manson's place in the music culture of the time?
By latching on to Dennis Wilson, Manson thought that gave him immediate entree into getting his ultimate dream, being signed to a recording contract and getting to be a bigger star than the Beatles. The fact that Manson is very, very adequate at best as a songwriter and performer has nothing to do with the fantasy that he built up. Charlie Manson had nothing that would make you notice him as a musician. He had great personality, he had charisma, but in a recording studio where the music has to carry you, it wasn't there.
You know, Charles Manson will never get out of prison. But weirdly, and this book really emphasizes this, he is still a living part of our culture. You talk about kids who wear Manson T-shirts, about bands, many bands, who recorded parts of his songs like Guns N' Roses. What on earth is the draw that Charles Manson has now?
Since those terrible nights, August 1969, how many more horrific murders have we had in America? The media made so much of Manson at the time. It was an era in America and the world where anything good or bad could happen. Men walked on the moon. The Mets won the pennant. Woodstock and the Manson murders. But the other thing is, I think Charlie would be modestly remembered but mostly forgotten now if he'd been executed, as was his original sentence. But the California courts overturned the death penalty. Just before his final arrest, he called the family together and explained to them if he was ever arrested, he was going to put on his Crazy Charlie act. And he has maintained the Crazy Charlie act all these years since, and people have bought into it. What may have happened in all these 43 years since is he's done it so long, he doesn't know the difference between that and himself anymore. But from the beginning, it was calculated, and you have to give the man credit, even though it's a disgusting sort of credit. It's worked.
That's Jeff Gwynn. He is the author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff Gwynn, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. It's time for some music. Elephant music. This is the Thai Elephant Orchestra. The elephants play enormous percussion instruments, holding mallets in their trunks and sometimes trumpeting along. The man behind this extraordinary venture is the experimental musician who goes by Dave Soldier. He says the elephants playing this music live at a Thai conservation center near Chiang Mai, where former work animals with nowhere to go stay.
Most of these elephants were working in the logging industry, and they needed somewhere to put them. The elephants can live to be 60 years old and older, and elephants like to listen to music. If you play music, they'll come over, and in the morning when the mahouts take them out of the jungle, they sing to them to calm them down.
Those are their keepers.
That's right. So what we came up with was, well, maybe if we made ergonomic instruments that would be easy for elephants to play, for instance, marimbas and drums that are giant, perhaps they would play music.
So let's talk about a couple of these instruments. One of them is like a xylophone, and it sounds kind of like bells. Let's listen to a little bit of that. Now, this is a six-year-old elephant named Fong, and it's so pretty. How did you build this instrument?
Well, I built that at a metal shop in Lampang, but the idea here was to make music that sounds like Thai music. For instance, that instrument that you just heard is using a Thai scale, and when Thai people hear it, they say, oh, that sounds like some of the music that we play in the Buddhist temples up north.
It's really haunting music. Let's listen to another song. This one features, and multiple instruments, an orchestral composition. What are we hearing?
You're hearing 14 elephants playing on 14 different instruments, all live, no overdubs, no editing, out in essentially clearing in the jungle in northern Thailand.
So often you have humans who play along with them or sing along with them, and we can hear an example of that in this piece. It's called Invocation.
That's Bunyang, and Bunyang is a mahout, and he's one of the most respected mahouts for a couple of reasons. First, he's in charge of one of the largest and most badass elephants. It's a fellow named Lukop, who can be very difficult. And the religion in that area is Buddhism, but it's very, very flavored by the traditional animist religion of northern Thailand that was there before. And this prayer that he's singing is one of those animist prayers. It is a prayer to the elephant spirit.
So, David Soldier, you've released three albums with the Thai Elephant Orchestra. It's really enchanting listening, but do people say to you, it's really nice, is this music?
We have a wonderful answer for that, and I hope some of your listeners take it to heart and give it a shot. What you do is you play some of the music to your friends or an audience. We did this once to a professional music critic from the New York Times who got pretty upset with me afterwards. And you say, who's playing? You know, is this music? And they'll say, of course it's music. So far everyone has. And you ask them to guess which group it is. That particular music critic eventually said, I bet it's a new music group from Asia. I said, you got it.
Oh, he's pretty right. David Sulzer is a neuroscientist at Columbia, his day job. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
For the week ending August the 4th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Sarah Ventry, Rachel Rood, and Elliot Hannon. Our intern is Jan Stewart. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Bethoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden, and we'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.